In the 60s, lots of stuff was changing, at least in certain parts of the country, let's say, just to talk about America. Lots of stuff was changing, but there was this kind of sense that people were part of this bigger flow of history, that there was sort of a transformative moment on the horizon, whether it was political or spiritual or both, that there was some kind of mass transformation that's going to on the horizon. And for a variety of reasons, that didn't happen. And so a lot of people kind of woke up in the early 70s going, what happened? Where are we? And, you know, they're kind of blown out. And what gets constituted then, what gets constructed in America in the 70s, in the early 70s, is kind of a different nation, one that's able to take into account some of these new social movements and new identities and new experiences, but also kind of make them less revolutionary. And so you enter into a very pluralistic, that's really where pluralistic America begins, your pluriverse.
This time on the Plutopia News Network, author, journalist, and fellow podcaster Eric Davis joins John and Scoop in the virtual studio. We discuss Eric's latest book, High Weirdness, Led Zeppelin 4, Philip K. Dick, and much more. All participants are wearing virtual face masks and gloves for the safety of our virtual listeners.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Plutopia. Our guest for this episode of the Plutopia News Network is Eric Davis, author of High Weirdness, Drugs, Esoterica, and Visionary Experience in the 70s. Eric's a writer, journalist, and historian who's written about technology, culture, rock and roll, and esoteric mysticism. A great combination and very compelling. So, Eric, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right today, you know, just kind of living this weird life.
Sometimes it seems
kind of ordinary. I'm used to working at home and, you know, doing stuff in my neighborhood. And then other times it's very strange.
So, speaking of weird, your book is about high weirdness. And early in the book, you talk about the meaning of the word weird. So what is weird?
Yeah, I'm kind of interested in it. It's a term we use a lot. Like if you listen to people's ordinary speech, you know, it's often used and it has somewhat set of different meanings. But it's not something we actually really think about as like a claim about reality or the nature of things. And so in a way, it's kind of a mystery hidden in plain sight, because I think it actually helps describe some really interesting things, particularly from a kind of subcultural perspective or a psychedelic perspective or a visionary perspective or even a technological one, which is that, you know, there's something anomalous about things when we look closely at them. And it doesn't mean it's supernatural or mystical or religious. It just means it's kind of weird. And, you know, like an example is like, well, let's say you have a dream and then the next, and you remember it and when you wake up, it's a vivid dream. You know, you run into an old friend and there's something about a dolphin. And then that later that afternoon, you're like, you run into the same friend in the same situation as in your dream. And he's holding like a stuffed dolphin and you're like, whoa. And you're telling this story to somebody and you don't want to say that it proves that reality is an interdimensional matrix of cosmic forces or some larger claim. All you can really say is like, yeah, weird. It's like, we all know what that is. There's this kind of zone of experience, of things, of people, when stuff starts to get weird. And for me, it was a really good way in to understanding and grappling with periods of, high strangeness, when things really start to become peculiar, whether it's in a paranormal account, a UFO encounter, a crazy psychedelic trip, a mystical vision, a synchronicity. You know, there's this whole kind of cluster of things that we don't really know what to do with as sort of modern rational people. And for me, the category of the weird is actually really helpful because it's already out there. You know, everything from weird tales, you know, where Lovecraft wrote and the whole genre of weird fiction got going, and to quantum weirdness, which is like a common term that people use to describe the really powerfully counterintuitive aspects of physical reality according to quantum mechanics. And it's just a term of art just to refer to quantum weirdness because it's weird. So there's some kind of sympathy between these different ways of using the term that really I found very useful as a way into talking about these wild visionary and psychedelic experiences, particularly in the 70s.
You talk about high weirdness in the dreams. Let's talk about weirdness. My wife is a big fan of the TV show Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and she's binge-watching it now. And just the other night, they were dealing with Buffy the Vampire Slayer's dreams all coming true. She would see these things in the dreams, and of course, then they would be worked out in real life. And it's strange how widespread that belief is.
Oh, it's definitely true. And it's also interesting about weird is that it describes experiences like that, like having the sense that your dreams are predicting reality, and you're like, that's a weird claim. But it's also kind of certain kinds of media are weird. And one of the things that's weird about weird media is that it kind of gets under your skin. Like you thought you were reading a fiction, and then now you're thinking it's actually about reality. And you know, one of the guys that I write about in the book, Robert Anton Wilson, is sort of famous for that kind of thing of like playing games with conspiracy and alternate worldviews, and oh, it's just a lark, or it's just a TV show. But then something about it starts to like seep in, and then wait, maybe it wasn't just what we thought it was. And that feeling, which is something that some fictions and media just like to play with, that sense that there's something encoded in it, maybe it's more real than it seems, even if that's just an effect, it produces this characteristic of weird media, of media that gets under your skin. I can't say that Buffy ever got under my skin, but there's definitely other kinds of horror, supernatural, cosmic fictions like Lovecraft or Clark Ashton Smith that do get under your skin in an interesting way.
That really got to me. Well, so it's like the construction of reality that we all have, which is based somewhat on a consensus view of things, excludes some of what's actually there in the periphery of our reality, and it bleeds in sometimes, and it's like a big shock to the system.
Absolutely. That whole framework that you just laid out is something I'm really interested in. I mean, I've always been interested in like, what does it mean to have like one foot in the consensus side and then one foot kind of kicking open the door to that fringe, you know? And I mean that even also just as a scholar, or like a historian, which in many ways the materials are they're about consensus. They're like what we know about history, you know, and 1970 Nixon did this, and then there was Kent State, and we all kind of agree that that's part of this historical flow. But the more you look at those things, the more you start to see these cracks and gaps. And rather than try to paper them over or ignore them, I'm interested in what happens when that weird light kind of spills through, and even history starts to take on a bit of a quality of fable or of nightmare. And that's a kind of tension that really is part of what goes on when in my history of the 70s, is to, on the one hand, really tell a true story about what was going on with culture and technology and politics, but also to honor the way that those consensus stories have cracks in them, and that it's interesting to pay attention to those cracks where something else seems to be leaking in.
Yeah, it makes me think about the old Firesign Theater saying, everything you know is wrong.
Yeah, that's a great record. You know, I mean, there's a lot in there, you know, like their UFO conspiracy approaches are still relevant today.
In the 70s, I mean, we're talking about the social construction of reality here. What changed in the 70s where that construction of reality is concerned, that consensus thinking about what's real?
There's two things that I'm thinking of right now. One is just that something happened kind of after the utopian transformative vision of the counterculture was frustrated. So in the 60s, lots of stuff was changing, at least in certain parts of the country, let's say, just to talk about America. Lots of stuff was changing, but there was this kind of sense that people were part of this bigger flow of history, that there was sort of a transformative moment on the horizon, whether it was political or spiritual or both, that there was some kind of mass transformation that's going to on the horizon. And for a variety of reasons, that didn't happen. And so a lot of people kind of woke up in the early 70s going, what happened? Where are we? And, you know, they're kind of blown out. And what gets constituted then, what gets constructed in America in the 70s, in the early 70s, is kind of a different nation, one that's able to take into account some of these new social movements and new identities and new experiences, but also kind of make them less revolutionary. And so you enter into a very pluralistic, that's really where in pluralistic America begins, your pluriverse. And that's one of the things I talk about, is that that's when kind of the first steps towards diversity and multiple identities and different lifestyles as being legitimate, that becomes just sort of part of American culture, part of a popular culture. Even as the 60s habits of sex, drugs, and rock and roll start to spread throughout the country, you know, like in the 1968, you know, acid gobbling was relatively located in a number of urban centers for the most part. But by the mid 70s, LSD is everywhere. So even though it's not a psychedelic culture in the dynamic way that we associate with the Haight or Ann Arbor or Austin in the 60s, that by the 70s, it's actually permeating the culture and changing and unraveling people's sense of consensus. So that's one side that I talk about in the book that I think is really important. But the other side is more, or the other point is more meta, which is that you use that idea of the social construction of reality. We all kind of, you know, that's not a very strident claim these days. It's totally common in the humanities and history and even psychology, and a lot of us in the kind of fringe world, you know, take it for granted that there's this kind of construction process. And most sociologists will acknowledge it, and even people who want to insist on the truth of science can kind of understand how even scientific statements are sort of constructed, even if they have a quality of reality to them that we have to honor in a specific way, which I actually believe. But on another level, what happens in the 1970s is that the very idea of the social construction of reality becomes available. It's an available tool. The term itself comes from the 1960s, from Goodman, and I can't remember his writing partner right now, the social construction of reality. But then that becomes sort of part of the way that people are thinking about the world. So it becomes like a meta concept, or the secret is out. It's like the secret is out. We're actually making this up as we go along. And the very acknowledgement that that's true to a degree begins to change the whole story as well. And so one of the things that I'm talking about when I'm in my book, when I'm writing about these wild visionary experiences that Terence McKenna and Philip K. Dick and Robert Anton Wilson went through in the 70s, is that as they try to make meaning of their experiences, of their extreme experiences, as they try to cobble together a story that works for them, they're aware that the whole thing is kind of a construction. And that awareness creates this sort of postmodern slipperiness about what they're doing that, to my mind, is very relevant and very resonant about our whole mode of culture these days. And for me, a lot of that really starts in a big way in the 70s. Like, that to me is sort of the origins of a lot of this kind of meta reflexive postmodern hyper pluralistic reality construct that we inhabit now.
Eric, you mentioned sex, drugs, and rock and roll. The album Led Zeppelin IV seems to have some impression on you, and you, to the point that you wrote a book about it. What about Led Zeppelin IV was important?
Oh, that's a blast from the past. Yeah, well, you know, when they started that series, the 33 and a third, which has done very, very well, and there's hundreds of them now. I think mine is like number 17. And it was an interesting moment because I had written about rock and roll for a lot in the late 80s and early to mid 90s and kept writing about music, you know, till today, although I don't do it as often. I just wrote a big piece about Terry Riley for a book collection. So I still write about music when I can. I love writing about music. So when this new book series came along, 33 and a third, where each short volume was devoted to a single album, which is a great idea. A friend of mine did one. And he said, "Hey, man, you should do this." And so I was thinking about, well, what do I want to write about? And I thought about records that were a little bit more, I don't know, I want to say classy, hip, you know, and at that point, right, you know, Led Zeppelin, though, you know, admired widely and certainly enjoyed by many, wasn't exactly the hippest thing for a rock critic to write about. But once I landed on that one, I knew I had to do it. It's not even my favorite Led Zeppelin record, but it is the most iconic one, partly because it has Stairway to Heaven in it. But it also, the more I looked at it, the more I kind of started to hallucinate the sort of deeper meanings of the record. So it's almost kind of like what we were just talking about, the social construction of reality. So then I tried to say, hey, what if I like overread the record? What if I like try to squeeze every last bit of meaning out of this collection of rock and roll songs and just go with it and have fun with it? And that's what this book came into. So it ends up being this meditation on gender and magic and technology and seeking and all this, like, this very 70s kind of stuff. But I kind of do it through a close reading of this one particular record. And it was just a blast. It was definitely the most fun I ever had writing a book, or a book-length essay or a long essay. Because I just got totally into it, and I was able to kind of get in touch with my inner 14-year-old, and so my inner 14-year-old was enjoying this process along with me. Because I was such a Zep head when I was young, and so I kind of could kind of honor my own youthful enthusiasms, but bring a more ironic and hopefully insightful mind to bear on it. So. I still love Led Zeppelin, and I really that book's probably my favorite thing that I've done. I guess because I enjoyed writing it so much. A lot of these other things, like, I don't actually enjoy the writing process, even if I really like the book, or I'm really proud of it. You know, like High Weirdness is like it's a summa, it's a monster, it's like a game changer, or wants to be a game changer. Maybe it's not, but I wrote it to be one. But the actual process of writing it wasn't that fun. But the Zeppelin one, I look back with great fondness.
Well, back in that time, I was living in the Bay. I lived in the Bay Area for about 40 years, and I was a music journalist for a radio news service out of San Francisco. So I went to all of those shows, especially any Led Zeppelin show. I had to go there because that was what the editor wanted to hear about. And you talk about High Weirdness. Backstage with those guys, it takes High Weirdness to a whole new level.
Oh, I can only imagine. In fact, that's all I can do, since I wasn't there. But even just the imagining of it is kind of tells you something. Just like how far people would push it. Those guys, rock stars, lots of folks, you know, pushing into the weird, occultists, UFO freaks. I mean, it was a time to really push it.
Yeah, we interviewed Lou Scheiner, who wrote a book called Outside the Gates of Eden, which is a novel, a fiction, but he includes, among other things in that book, he includes a Led Zeppelin concert. And there was a concert, you may know this story. I think their manager and another guy beat somebody up backstage, like really beat him up badly. And that was included in the book that he wrote. He one of his characters is a bystander. So he was basically kind of trying to capture this strange energy that surrounded a Zeppelin concert. Though in that particular
great.
case, it went a little bit violent, which I don't think was always the case.
No, but there was some notorious acts of violence committed, particularly by John Bonham. There's a famous story. I think it was in Oakland or San Francisco. I think it was in Oakland. That was just, you know, crude, defenseless acts of you know, meanness. So yeah, there was definitely some Viking energy going on there.
Oh man,
I want to get back to High Weirdness. There was a real difference, I think, and I think that you get to this in the book, that Philip Dick was kind of really different from McKenna and Robert Anton Wilson, wasn't he? I mean, his experience, is part of it is that it seems that he was less proactive in the experience that he had.
Yeah, that would be a part where to do that. Like, they're a little bit apples and oranges on some level, although the more you come from the content of the experiences and the kinds of people or kinds of minds they had, there was a lot more similarity. But there was a fundamental difference in that both McKenna and Wilson were principally psychedelic people, and they were also both Prometheans, the idea that you just sort of, you know, you storm the gates of heaven with your psychoactive compounds. You put the pedal to the metal and see how far you can go and what you can come back with. And Dick was kind of more, it was more on the natch. You know, he was a sort of non-neurotypical visionary from the get-go. I mean, he had peculiar mental experiences and mental trauma, illness, whatever you want to call it, from the time he was a young boy, and also, you know, was part of all these different therapeutic regimens and drug regimens. And so he was much more in the kind of continuum of mental instability in a lot of ways. And so he almost maybe in related to that, what had a more kind of religious idea that like these experiences were happening to him. It wasn't something that he was going out and making happen. He did that a little bit. He tried different practices, and he listened to his dreams. He took vitamins. You know, he did stuff that he was trying to kind of poke his nervous system. But in other ways, he very much experienced it as something happening to him, like an incoming vision or a sense of conversion to something outside of himself. So in some ways, he has a different, very different quality. And of course, you know, he's not, though he was familiar with psychedelics and they influenced his books and to some extent his visions. The visions that he had in 1974 were almost exclusively not on drugs, and he wasn't really doing very many drugs at that point in his life.
Hadn't he been to the dentist when he had that pink light experience and maybe had nitrous oxide or something?
No, there's no real nitrous connection there that I've ever come across, even in you know, and there's a number of books now that have been written really trying to like hone in on what he was actually doing. And as far as I know, there's a couple of references to dentistry in interesting ways in some of the letters, but there's no description of going to the dentist and then having an experience. Unlike, of course, you know, L. Ron Hubbard, you know, the vision for Dianetics, you know, is in this Excalibur text that he wrote a few years before in the late 1940s. And it's very clear that the bulk of that vision that he had was a nitrous vision from at a dentist. So he had a huge nitrous, whatever, breakthrough or awakening or illumination that very much influenced these Scientologist visions, which are, you know, not unrelated in some ways to some of the Gnostic science fiction visionary stuff that we talk about in High Weirdness, though I don't end up going in the Scientologist direction. It's definitely part of the same mutation on some level.
So how did you land on McKenna, Dick, and Wilson as the guys that you really wanted to focus on?
Well, I always wanted to write about Philip K. Dick. I thought that no one had ever really gone into like the reading the exegesis and analyzing his experiences and looking at it you know, really looking at it as a chapter in American religious history rather than a story about the science fiction writer, and really emphasizing, you know, most people writing about Dick write about the fiction. And I wanted to write about the fiction, but only as it was illuminating the life. And so I thought that there was some really interesting work to be done there. And then at a certain point, I just thought it would be more interesting to compare his experience, or at least parallel it with other experiences from that same space and time, really, from California in the 70s. I mean, they're not all California experiences, but there's a lot about that about that place in all of these stories. So it just felt like a broader comparative project would actually get at something bigger, you know, something more nebulous and zeitgeisty. Whereas if I just wrote about Dick, no matter what I said or however insightful it was, it's in the end, it's just about this one peculiar guy. But if you say, hey, this peculiar guy and this peculiar guy, this peculiar guy, and actually a bunch of other people that I mentioned, but I don't end up writing about it in depth, there's something very resonant and similar about a lot of their visions. So what's going on there? What is that similarity? Is it just that they're drawing from the same well? Is it something about the 1970s? Is it something about the changes in culture and technology? So it's kind of, in a way, it gives you like a wider lens to look through.
It seems like they were, one thing they had in common was that they were all trying to reconcile their subjective experience with something more universal.
Yeah, they were not happy with just saying, well, that was my weird experience. And at the same time, they weren't that happy with just, deciding that they were visionaries, you know, that they were, there was a kind of quality of skepticism or probing. So they were kind of navigating that connection between their own experiences and the world of truth in an interesting way.
Did they really think of themselves as visionaries?
I think Dick did to some degree. I mean, it was very important to him that he was having religious visions, that he talked about them in religious terms. And while sometimes he suspected that maybe he was just crazy, that he really like took it seriously. And so he in a way treated his own subconscious like a god or an oracle. So when he would sleep, one of the things that I do in the book that I kind of show that other people haven't talked about him is how developed his own dream practice was, and particularly about hypnagogic dreaming, the dreaming at the edge of sleep, or what my wife Jennifer Dumpert calls liminal dreaming, where you're a kind of in between rather than the deep sleep REM dreams. And he would sort of go into that state listening, ready to capture something. And he would pull back words or phrases from this phase of sleep. And the reason he did that was that he thought something was communicating to him through his unconscious. So whereas most of us would go, wow, yeah, I'm dreaming. It's a wild dream I had. You know, we don't make any claims for its origin, you know, originating with some kind of higher force. But for Dick, it was really important that something was contacting him. And I think at times, both McKenna and Wilson also believed that something was contacting them, particularly McKenna. And I think it was important to him, too, that he was a visionary who was vouchsafed this vision of the time wave, and he kind of had a duty to go out and spread the word of the mushroom. That kind of attitude was definitely part of his story. I think that Wilson was the most skeptical, the most willing to say, well, you know, I had a bunch of weird experiences, but that doesn't make me a religious visionary.
Dick's work seems to have had a extensive influence on popular culture, particularly just saying the word electric sheep will identify any Philip K. Dick fan, because they'll know exactly what you're speaking about. And it's, you know, interesting how many filmmakers were influenced by his work. You know, the obvious movie there, and Richard Linklater did A Scanner Darkly, and, you know, there have been many other people that were influenced by just the act of reading one of his novels.
Yeah, there's a whole side of Philip K. Dick that's just all about the movies. And you know, for me, that one of the interesting things there that's almost synchronistic or prophetic even is that in his great novel about his visionary experiences, Valis, which came out, you know, in 1980 or 81, there's a film in the story, and basically the first half of the novel is more or less autobiographical about Dick and being depressed and freaked out and having these weird experiences. And he tells it in terms of he splits his own person into two characters, but it's more or less autobiographical. And then at a certain point in the novel, Dick stand-in and his friends, they go see this movie, and it's this pulp science fiction movie. And then they called Valis. And then they start to interpret it like, oh, remember that scene? We see that fish symbol on a jug. And then like, yeah, but isn't that the same thing that's in the guy's office? And it's, again, it's like a really pulpy, you know, exploitation movie, you know, sort of a psychotronic film. But then as they start to interpret it, that leads them into the second half of the novel, which is much more of a kind of science fiction fantasy where they meet the savior and they meet these, you know, characters that are just completely made up. And so it's interesting that in his own telling of his story, the film and the idea particularly that movies contain secrets, subliminal messages or signs, that's actually a really important part of his story, because in a way Phil Dick is mostly kind of subliminal in the movies, even the ones that have been made on his work, because they're pretty different, they miss a lot of the stuff. You know, there's some that are truer to spirit than others, but it's still, there's a way in which they all kind of cover over, you know, what it's like to really encounter Dick's writing. So it's like, that's how he's gone out in the world, is he's in like these pulp science fiction movies. But if you start putting the pieces together, they'll lead you down the rabbit hole, and you'll find yourself facing the kind of larger enigmas of Dick's own work. There's only a few films that I think really get to his level of high weirdness, but it's an amazing thing. And then there's movies that don't even mention him explicitly, like Inception, that are still totally Dickian. I mean, in a way, at this point, if there's a movie or a fiction about a false reality that begins to break down, even if there's no reference to Dick, it's kind of like his own genre in a way.
I find myself wondering how any of those three guys would respond to the kind of situation we're in now with a global pandemic at our doorstep. Have you thought about that?
Yeah, you know, I don't really know I don't have a big story about what's going on. And I don't think I think people would be surprised about it. I think that one connection that is there is just the very metaphor of a virus. I mean, the virus was a really important figure for William S. Burroughs, who of course talked about language as a virus, you know, as a kind of control mechanism that keeps us locked in, and the escape lies through kind of breaking the spell. And but that things spread like viruses, and that was an important image, particularly for Phil Dick. He talked about Valis, this kind of incoming spiritual force, also as kind of a virus or something that would infect our world. Like he saw our world, at least a lot of the time, as kind of a fallen, broken Xerox copy of a real world, that we're sort of lost in a kind of deluded, illusionary prison. And that what Valis does, it's this kind of either extraterrestrial or divine force, is that it sneaks through our world and it kind of infects it with like a virus-like quality. And they'll even use the word virus sometimes to compare it. He also talks about the homeoplasmate that takes people over through their eyes when they read certain texts. So this idea of like the divine spark is a kind of virus that's hidden inside our fallen delusional reality is a really key vision for Dick. And so even though he saw it in a positive light, there's still something about the viral quality of the virus that makes this really interesting, as opposed to being a bacterium or a germ or whatever. There's something about because what are viruses? You know, technically, well, you know, we can argue till the cows come home about whether they're alive or not, but they're definitely replicators.
Their genetic code.
Yeah.
And they're transformative. Their genetic code that get into a cell and transform the cell.
Right. Well, they do it through replicating. So that's why they go, well, is that life? I mean, life's kind of replicating. Well, it's not quite life, at least according to some people, because it doesn't have, you know, it doesn't have DNA, it just has RNA, and it doesn't da-da-da, blah-blah-blah. And you're like, okay, but what is it actually doing? Well, it's replicating itself. Iterative, right? You know, it's like a really clever, it's like malware. So in a way, like the technical quality of viruses, I think, is really resonant for us today and is a kind of appropriate given how technologized our society and, you know, our social life, our psyches are. So I think that everyone would have been interested in the virus as a virus. In terms of what's happening now.
It's interesting to think about something sort of alien that is actually within yourself. I was just thinking a minute ago when you were talking, I was thinking about Colin Wilson and the mind parasites.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's definitely part of the picture, you know, and then you get into that kind of conspiratorial mind frame that's related to a lot of these currents, certainly to all three of the guys I wrote about were also paranoids at point, particularly Dick and Wilson, and Wilson definitely elaborated a whole kind of Gnostic mythology of archons and Illuminati, and you know, and he kind of mostly did it in fun. There's definitely a quality to which this kind of thinking lends itself to the idea that there are mind parasites out there. There are mimetic replicators that don't have our best interests at heart, that we carry sometimes whether we want to or not. And that kind of viewpoint really goes with the high weirdness model.
Does that relate to social media as a carrier of memes that are like viruses?
Sure, if you want to. I mean, you know, we already obviously use that metaphor widely of something going viral, and I think it's because we do sense that social media in particular, but other mechanisms as well, has just created an environment where things can spread faster and more ferociously, and that they can look like, well, it's got to be true because all these people are talking about it at the same time. That sense of a kind of mass swarming of memes. So when memes start to swarm, then they become more and more real, even if they're completely concocted. And that we are now swimming in that sea.
Some of the conspiracy theorists are saying that the Illuminati are responsible for putting 5G out there so it can either control our brains or kill us or God knows what. There's so many of those out there.
It's true. 5G is definitely part of the picture. And, you know, for me, like a lot of these stories, I tend to look at them as sort of allegories, meaning that they're like folkloric stories about something that's really happening. So, you know, I don't think that 5G technology is making people susceptible to COVID-19. I think that. But on the other hand, I do think that the rollout of 5G is a worrying development that has political, economic, and biological components to it, and that our fears about it, in a way, are legitimate in the sense that this is being kind of rammed down our throat and that there's a number of really outsized concerns around it, but nobody has any agency. And when you don't have any agency, the best way to feel like you have some kind of control is to settle on a very strong story that you settle on without a lot of ambivalence or ambiguity, because it gives you a sense of clarity around something that you otherwise feel powerless and overwhelmed by. And so I think that, you know, conspiracies are there for a reason. They're not just bad ways of thinking that get reproduced in our chaotic meme environment. I think they're also resonant and sometimes true or part of the truth that are worth, that are important to pay attention to, even though I have a lot of problems with the way that most people reproduce them and most people work with them.
Things that we fear that are sort of beyond our comprehension. We don't have a clear understanding. We don't know enough about them. So we sort of construct a narrative internally that may be crazy, you know, or it may be completely unreal, but it's the best meaning that we can make of it.
Yeah, they're definitely, it's part of meaning making. And in fact, part of the problem with meaning making is how do you develop your own ways of making meaning where you don't fall into some of those traps, even though you recognize their attraction or even their validity. And that's a whole issue. I feel like a lot of people who I talk to who are really into conspiracies, there's a certain part where they actually, even though they're so critical of the dominant mainstream story, they're so critical and skeptical and questioning of these dominant stories, people are often extremely naive and unquestioning about their own sources of information. And I think that happens partly because, like you say, it is about fear. And even if you have a story that's a scary story, you know, it's not just that 5G is a kind of problematic technology that's being rolled out without, you know, democratic accountability, and it's doing it largely to make other people money and, you know, to increase like surveillance capitalism. And that's sort of what I would say about it. No, it's actually being done to like rot our minds and, you know, control us, turn us into a zombie army. Well, that's a scarier story. That's a more bleak and dystopian tale. But if you're really convinced that it's true, it actually gives you some energy, it gives you some clarity of purpose, some kind of a noble role to play as you go forward and announce this secret truth that everyone else is denying. So they're very seductive that way, because even if they're bleak and they resonate with your sense that reality is really screwed up, they also kind of secretly deliver a certain kind of satisfaction to the ego that is otherwise terrified by confusion, powerlessness, and just the fog of media that we're all in now.
My favorite cliche for conspiracies is, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. And there's some truth to that.
Yeah, that's a very much of a Robert Anton Wilson kind of spirit as well. I mean, his attitude was like towards conspiracy was like, bring it on, you know, and he was fascinated by it. And he studied some real world conspiracies very deeply, you know, ones that involve like, you know, actual historical institutions of international banks and the Vatican and terrorists. And, you know, he really dove into some historical kind of journalistic networks of hidden forces that were behind events in the 1970s and 80s. And he knew a lot about historical conspiracies going back with the Masons and things like that. But at the same time, even as he was taking on a lot of sometimes even paranoid possibilities, he kind of kept a joie de vivre about the whole thing, like a sort of lightness and humor, as if like part of the game is not to get captured by the doomy militant seriousness that swallows up so many conspiracy people. I mean, for me, if someone is putting forward conspiracy and they don't have the capacity to see how they look, or they don't have the capacity to sympathize with how someone would think they were a little bit over the top, and if they're just stridently insisting on their perspective, even if it's an interesting perspective, I usually just don't really have much time for it, because I can so see the psychological function. Now, other people I know are very sophisticated and they can maintain many points of view, but they have some that where they're really invested in some, you know, really dark control scenarios about, you know, mind control and social control and things like that. Yeah, I think we got to look at that stuff. It's part of the picture. It's always been part of the picture in the modern world. But it require, you have to have more, I think you need to be more mature psychologically and philosophically to be able to go into those waters and come back with something that's really useful. And most people just don't have the chops and they get lost.
I lean more in the direction of pronoia. you know, pronoia is the feeling that the world is out to do you good.
Can you? Is there a pronoic perspective on the virus?
Yeah. I mean, actually, I've been prone to a number of conversations about the positive side of the impact of the virus. Some people who sort of thought things needed to be burned down in order to build something better see the virus as a way to do that, you know, a way to sort of end capitalism, for instance, and replace it with some better thing, which, you know, fingers crossed, I'm not sure that's going to happen. But one thing that has clearly happened is that the environment, the air is much cleaner now. It's cleared up in a big way because people are not out driving their cars as much, you know? I think that a lot of flights have been canceled. I mean, we're just not churning as much, as many emissions into the environment, and it might have an impact on climate change. It might have an impact on our respiratory health in a positive way, even though the disease itself, of course, can lead to a respiratory shutdown.
One of the darkest things that I've seen is people theorizing that the only way we're going to save the environment is a mass die-off. And there is some credibility to that theory, but it scares the hell out of me.
Well, this does present itself as a cure for the population explosion. You know, just weed them out, take people away.
I think those are all, you know, important points to consider, but it's also just people have if you were kind of resisting seeing the way that our society is not, there's a lot of features of our society that aren't working very well, at least for most people, and I think it's a lot more visible now, and that visibility is really helpful, even if it's difficult or kind of scary or overwhelming because there's so many problems. But that visibility, I think a lot more people are seeing more crisply some of the problems and the fragility and the imbalance of modern society, coupled with seeing how quickly human behavior can actually change in light of something of a significant development. And that is quietly hopeful from a kind of climate change point of view, because if, you know, we're seeing what the enormous costs and challenges of this situation, and, you know, there's a lot more coming down the pike. And so I have some quiet hope that people will be able to recognize that, oh, well, we just have to restore business as usual, that the people who want business as usual again is business, not people.
Yeah.
And that's just very visceral. And whether it's going to work out in a positive way, a negative way, or a mix, I really feel like that has shifted a lot of people around the world. At least I would like to think that. And they realize that it's not about going back to the way it was before, but that we have to go forward in some manner or another and make some changes, hopefully, in a more significant way than we have up to now. Because up to now, oh, we just got to keep doing what we've been doing, just more of it. And now we're like, no, we don't have to. Look, things can actually be different. So I think that's
things can change.
I don't think business as usual is going to return at all, because I read a lot of European history in college and took some courses in my senior year, and they dealt a lot with the post Black Plague of society, and it was nothing like the society that came before the Black Plague. And I think we're going to see a similar kind of change. As businesses won't be a lot of businesses won't be coming back. They've already been killed.
Yeah, no, we're going to see a really, really different economic landscape.
And you know, we're really going to have to think hard now, and we're having to think hard now about the value of a human life. And, you know, do we really believe that the economy is more important than the life of, like, people who are vulnerable in some way? Do we really think it's okay to just let people die, you know, in the Dan Patrick sense of it? And I don't think people really believe that. And people are making that argument. Interestingly, that argument comes from people who are Republicans who also profess to be pro-life. And to say that you're pro-life and to say at the same time that it doesn't really bother you to let people die if you think that's what it takes to bring the economy back, that raises a lot of questions, you know, a lot of ethical questions.
Yeah, that's true, you know, and although there is a kind of triage aspect to the whole picture, and, you know, we the societies make those determinations consciously, usually not consciously, you know, all the time. And that's that. Just the idea, though, that people are asking what is the value is great. I mean, even if some of the answers are frightening, like the idea of, like, you know, sacrificing grandma for, you know, for the sake of the S&P 500 is, like, so shocking when you see it so nakedly expressed. One thing that is happening is that everybody is forced to go, oh, yeah, society isn't just this inevitable machine. It's something where certain values are being held more than other values. And there's a conflict there between what those values are. Oh, wow, let's see that. Let's look at that. Rather than just reflexively saying, oh, it's obvious we just need to sacrifice people for the sake of the economy. Or, no, it's obvious we should tear down the entire economy to save two people. You know, I'm not saying anybody's doing that. But that there are extremes on the other side as well. And we're navigating this in-between zone, I think, in a very, very interesting way.
Yeah, the in-between is very interesting. I mean, there hadn't been in public conversation, there hadn't been enough consideration of what are the things that we might do that would not kill a bunch of people, but at the same time would allow the economy to come back. You know, Korea solved that problem to an extent. We probably could too, but there's.
Well, we might have to give up on certain freedoms and or install a higher degree of surveillance that we're completely legitimate to believe might not ever go away. So
yeah,
that's an interesting call, and that's going to be definitely lying, you know, in the future in terms of if there's the kind of moderated, controlled return to a more open situation. Well, those controls are going to involve health and temperature and who you've been in contact with and keeping track of that information. So, you know, that's another sort of value or payoff or trade-off that I suspect will be part of the future unfolding as well.
We're about out of time, but there's a question I really wanted to ask you, which is knowing that you put a lot of time and effort and energy into creating the book, which I should also mention is available now as an audio book, and that's recent. But I'm just wondering if having written the book and having it's been published now and you've had some time to think about it, are there things that you've thought of that you wish you had thought of while you were still writing the book?
You know, I learned a long time not to really do that too much. I mean, unless there's just overt errors, you know, I've put some errors in, nothing really in this book, but there's a couple of howlers in some of my earlier books, and I feel bad about those, but I don't really overthink about, oh, I could have done this or I could have done that. I mean, it just is what it is. It's like,
I'm just wondering if the book pointed you to, like, once the book was published, if you sort of felt that you evolved an even better understanding of the subjects that you covered in the book.
Yeah, I think I have a better sense now of what the way in which the book is also about now, in talking about it, mostly, like, as I started to talk about it with people and did a lot of podcasts about it, that has encouraged me to see what I was doing in a different way. So I kind of understand both my own motivations, why I was interested in these particular stories, but also the way in which I think these issues are really relevant in a lot of ways as the world just gets weirder, as it just becomes more peculiar, unpredictable, dreamlike, nightmarish in some ways, you know, marvelously bizarre in others, and also very difficult. And I think there's some resonance there that's really important, and it's clear to me having finished the book and talking about it than when I was writing it, when I was really just focused on the time period and these particular texts and experiences.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, it was great to be here.
Let's talk again sometime.
Excellent.
Learn more about Eric at technosis.com. That's technosis.com. You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for at Plutopia News. On Twitter, it's at Plutopia. With John Lubkowski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.